Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I ended the last show looking over the rainbow, which is a government without taxes or debt. As from The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy sang to her dog, Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. We must be over the rainbow. But the truth is that going over the rainbow suggests a radical visionary shift, a breakthrough into a new way of seeing the world. As far as the web of debt analysis is concerned, we have come to the end of the yellow brick road, and only a radical shift in our concepts of money and banking will save us from the cement wall, which is looming ahead. We, the people, really got lost in the labyrinth of debt when we allowed paper money to represent an illusory sum of gold held by private bankers, who multiplied it many times over in the guise of fractional reserve lending. The result was a Ponzi scheme that has pumped the global money supply into a gigantic credit bubble. As bond investor Bill Gross said in a February 2004 newsletter, we have been skipping down this yellow brick road of capitalism, paved not with gold, but with thick coats of debt leverage that requires constant maintenance. Close quote. The levies that have kept a flood of debt leverage from collapsing the economy showed signs of cracking on February 27, 2007, when the Dow Jones Industrial suddenly dropped by more than 500 points. The drop was triggered by a series of events like those initiating the Great Crash of 1929. A nearly 9% decline in China's stock market set off a wave of selling in U.S. markets to satisfy margin calls, that is, requiring investors using credit to add cash to their accounts to bring them to a certain minimum balance. The Chinese drop, in turn, was triggered by an intentional credit squeeze by Chinese officials who were concerned that Chinese homeowners were mortgaging their homes and businessmen were pledging their businesses as collateral to play the over-leveraged Chinese stock market. Commentators suggested that the Dow fell by only 500 points because of the behind-the-scenes maneuverings of the Plunge Protection Team, the Counterparty Risk Management Policy Group, and the Federal Reserve. But it was all just window dressing, a dog and pony show to keep investors lulled into complacency, inducing them to keep betting on a stock market nag on its last legs. A bigger crisis next time might not be so easy to conceal behind a facade of prosperity. Like at the end of the Roaring Twenties, we are again looking down the trough of the business cycle, mortgaged up to the gills and at a risk of losing it all. We own nothing that can't be taken away. The housing market could go into a further tailspin, and so could the stock market. The dollar could collapse, and so could our savings. Even Social Security and pensions could soon be things of the past. Before the economy collapses and our savings and security go with it, we need to reverse the sleight of hand that created the banker's Ponzi scheme. The constitutional provision that Congress shall have the power to coin money needs to be updated so that it covers the national currency in all forms, including the 97% now created with accounting entries by private commercial banks. That modest change could transform the dollar from a vice for wringing the lifeblood out of a nation of sharecroppers into a bell for ringing in the millennial abundance envisioned by our forefathers. The government could actually eliminate taxes and the federal debt while expanding the services it provides. But all this has really been a puzzle, so let's go over the 19 main points that are the pieces to the monetary puzzle, which have been concealed by layers of deception built up over 400 years, and it has taken some time to unravel them. But the picture really has now become clear, and we can recap what we've found. The global debt web has been spun from a string of frauds, deceits, and sleight of hands, and the puzzle pieces are as follows. 1. And the principal thing is the fractional reserve banking system. It was formalized in 1694 with the Charter for the Bank of England. The modern banking system involves credit issued by private bankers that is ostensibly backed by reserves. At one time, these reserves consisted of gold, but today they are merely government securities, promises to pay. The banking system lends these securities many times over, essentially counterfeiting them. The system has switched from assets as the basis of money to debt as the basis of money. The second point is the gold standard. In the 19th century, the government was admonished not to issue paper fiat money on the ground that it would produce dangerous inflation. The bankers insisted that paper money had to be backed by gold. What they failed to disclose was that there was not nearly enough gold in their own vaults to back the privately issued paper notes laying claim to them. The bankers themselves were dangerously inflating the money supply based on a fictitious gold standard that allowed them to issue loans many times over on the same gold reserves, collecting interest each time. And for those of you just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So continuing with the third piece of the puzzle, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve was established in 1913 to create a national money supply. The Federal Reserve is not federal, and today it keeps nothing in reserve except government bonds or IOUs. It is a private banking corporation authorized to issue its own Federal Reserve notes and sell them to other financial institutions, which then lend them to the government, individuals, and businesses. Except for coins, which make up about only 1/10,000th of the money supply, the entire U.S. money supply is now created by the private Federal Reserve and private banks by extending loans to the government and to individuals and businesses. The fourth point is the federal debt and the money supply. The U.S. went off the gold standard in the 1930s, but the fractional reserve system continued, backed by reserves of government bonds. The federal debt these securities represent is never paid off, but is continually rolled over, forming the basis of the national money supply. As a result of this highly inflationary scheme, by the fall of 2008, the federal debt had passed $10 trillion and was approaching the point at which the interest alone would be more than the public could afford to pay. As of 2012, this debt has gone to $15.5 trillion. And we are well past the point where the public can afford to pay the interest on the loans. The fifth point is the federal income tax. Considered unconstitutional for over a century, the federal income tax was ostensibly legalized in 1913 by the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. It was instituted primarily to secure a reliable source of money to pay the interest due to the bankers on the government's securities, and that continues to be its principal use today. The sixth point is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the International Monetary Fund. A principal function of the Federal Reserve was to bail out banks that got overextended in the fractional reserve shell game, using money created in an open market operations by the Fed. When the Federal Reserve failed in that backup function, the FDIC and then the IMF were instituted, ensuring that mega banks considered too big to fail would get bailed out no matter what risks they took. The seventh point is the free market. The theory that businesses in America prosper or fail due to free market forces is a myth. While smaller corporations and individuals who miscalculate their risks may be left to their fate in the market, mega banks and corporations considered too big to fail are protected by a form of federal welfare available only to the rich and powerful. Other distortions in free market forces result from the covert manipulations of a variety of powerful entities. Virtually every market is now manipulated, whether by federal mandate or by institutional speculators, hedge funds, and large multinational banks colluding on trades. The eighth point is the Plunge Protection Team and the Counterparty Risk Management Policy Group, the CRMPG. Federal manipulation is done by the Working Group on Financial Markets, also known as the Plunge Protection Team, the PPT. The PPT is authorized to use U.S. Treasury funds to rig markets in order to maintain investor confidence, keeping up the appearance that all is well. Manipulation is also effected by a private fraternity of big New York banks and investment houses known as the CRMPG, which was set up to bail its members out of financial difficulty by colluding to influence markets, again with the blessings of the government, and to the detriment of the small investors on the other side of these orchestrated trades. The ninth point is the floating exchange rate. Manipulation and collusion also occur in international currency markets. Rampant currency speculation was unleashed in 1971 when the United States defaulted on its promise to redeem its dollars in gold internationally. National currencies were left to float against each other, trading as if they were commodities rather than receipts for fixed units of value. The result was to remove the yardstick for measuring value, leaving currencies vulnerable to attack by international speculators prowling in these dangerous commercial waters. The 10th point is the short sale. To bring down competitor currencies, speculators use a device called the short sale. The sale of currency the speculator does not own but has theoretically borrowed just for purposes of sale. Like fractional reserve lending, the short sale is actually a form of counterfeiting. When speculators sell a currency short in massive quantities, its value is artificially forcing down the value of goods traded in it. The 11th point is globalization and free trade. Before a currency can be brought down by speculative assault, the country must be induced to open its economy to free trade and to make its currency freely convertible into other currencies. The currency can then be attacked and devalued, allowing national assets to be picked up at fire sale prices and forcing the country into bankruptcy. The bankrupt country must then borrow from international banks and the IMF, which impose as a condition of debt relief that the national government may not issue the money it needs, but must borrow it from international lenders. If the government tries to protect its resources or its banks by nationalizing them for the benefit of its own citizens, it is branded communist, socialist, or terrorist, and is replaced by one that is friendlier to free enterprise. Locals who fight back are termed terrorists or insurgents. The 12th point is inflation myths. The runaway inflation suffered by third world countries has been blamed on irresponsible governments running the money printing presses, when in fact, these disasters have usually been caused by speculative attacks on the national currency. Devaluing the currency forces prices to shoot up overnight. Creeping inflation, like that seen in the United States today, is also blamed on the government's irresponsibly printing money, when it is actually caused by private banks inflating the money supply with debt. Banks advance new money as loans that must be repaid with interest, but the banks don't create the interest necessary to service the loans. New loans must continually be taken out to obtain the money to pay the interest, forcing prices up in an attempt to cover this new cost, spiraling the economy into perpetual price inflation. And point 13, the business cycle. As long as banks keep making low interest loans, the money supply expands and business booms. But when the credit bubble gets too large, the central bank goes into action to deflate it. Interest rates are raised, loans are called, and the money supply shrinks, forcing debtors into foreclosure, delivering their homes and farms to the banks. This is called the business cycle, as if it were a natural condition like the weather. In fact, it is a natural characteristic only of a monetary scheme in which money comes into existence as a debt to private banks for reserves or something lent over many times. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we're up to point 14, the home mortgage boondoggle. A major portion of the money created by banks today originates with the monetization of home mortgages. The borrower thinks he is borrowing pre-existing funds when the bank is just turning his promise to pay into an asset secured by real property. By the time the mortgage is paid off, the borrower has usually paid the bank more in interest than was owed on the original loan. And if he defaults, the bank winds up with the house, although the money advanced to purchase it was created with accounting entries. The 15th point is the housing bubble. Until 2007, the dollar and the economy were being supported by a housing boom that was initiated when the Fed pushed interest rates to very low levels after the stock market collapsed in 2000, significantly shrinking the money supply. Easy credit pumped the money supply back up and saved the market investments of the Fed's member banks, but it also led to a housing bubble that would inevitably collapse as well, sending the economy to the trough of the business cycle once again. The next point then is 16, the adjustable rate mortgage, or ARM. After interest rates were dropped to very low levels, the housing bubble was fanned into a blaze through a series of high-risk changes in mortgage instruments, including variable rate loans that allowed nearly anyone to qualify to buy a home who would take the bait. By 2005, about half of all U.S. mortgages were at adjustable interest rates. Purchasers were lulled by teaser rates into believing they could afford mortgages that were liable to propel them into inextricable debt, if not into bankruptcy. Payments could increase by 50% after 6 years just by their terms, and could increase by 100% if interest rates went up by a mere 2% in 6 years. Point 17 is the secret bankruptcy of the banks. The banks themselves were taking enormous risks with their housing loans, as well as with very risky investments known as derivatives, which are basically side bets that some asset will go up or down. Banks were led into these dangerous waters because traditional commercial banking had proven to be an unprofitable venture. While banks have the power to create money as loans, they also have the obligation to balance their books. And when borrowers default, the losses must be made up from the bank's profits. Faced with a wave of bad debts and lost business, banks have kept afloat by branching out into economically destructive derivatives business and by colluding with each other and the government to arrange periodic stealth bailouts when banks considered too big to fail became insolvent. The 18th point is vulture capitalism and derivatives cancer. At one time, banks served the community by providing loans to developing businesses. But today, this essential credit function is being replaced by a form of vulture capitalism in which bank investment departments and affiliated hedge funds are buying out shareholders and bleeding businesses of their profits using loans of phantom money created on a computer screen. Banks are also funding speculative derivative bets in which money that should be going into economic productivity is merely gambled on money making money in the casino of the markets. Outstanding derivatives are now counted in the hundreds of trillions of dollars, many times the money supply of the world. And last is 19, moral hazard. The derivatives bubble is showing clear signs of imploding. And when it does, those banks considered too big to fail will expect to be bailed out from the consequences of their risky loans, just as they have been in the past. So those are the 19 pieces of the debt web puzzle, most of which the masses of people, both in the country and the world, know little or nothing about. We are all in a paradigm and, in a sense, just live and work in it and do not comprehend what has both created it or what can be done to expand out of it. So this is like waking up in Kansas. It's at this point in the story, if it is to have a happy ending, that we the people must snap ourselves awake, stand up, and say, enough. The banker's extremity is our opportunity. We can be kept indebted and enslaved only if we continue to underwrite bank profligacy. As Mike Whitney wrote in 2007, the Federal Reserve will keep greasing the printing presses and diddling the interest rates until someone takes away the punch bowl and the party comes to an end. End quote. It is up to us, an awakened and informed populace, to take away the punch bowl. Private commercial banking, as we know it, is frankly obsolete. And the vulture capitalist investment banking that has come to dominate the banking business is a parasite on productivity, serving its own interests at the expense of the public's. Rather than propping up a bankrupt banking system, Congress could and should put insolvent banks into receivership, claim them as public assets, and operate them as agencies serving the depository and credit needs of the people. The Ponzi scheme has reached its mathematical limits, forcing another paradigm shift if the economy is to survive. Will the collapse of the debt-based house of cards be the end of the world as we know it? Or will it be the way through the looking glass, a clarion call for change? We can be swept up by the tornado into debtor's prison, or we can step into the technicolor cornucopia of a money system based on the ingenuity and productivity that are the true wealth of a nation and its creative people. So like in The Wizard of Oz, we can make it home at last. In the happy ending to our modern monetary fairy tale, Congress takes back the power to create money in all its forms, including the money created with accounting entries by private banks. Highlights of this very satisfying ending would include 1. Elimination of personal income taxes, allowing workers to keep their wages, putting spending money in people's pockets, stimulating economic growth. 2. Elimination of mounting federal debt that must otherwise burden and bind future generations. 3. The availability of funds for a whole range of government services that have always been needed but could not be afforded under the fractional reserve system, including improved education, environmental cleanup and preservation, universal health care, restoration of infrastructure, independent medical research, and development of alternative energy sources. 4. A social security system that is sufficiently funded to support retirees, replacing private pensions that keep workers chained to unfulfilling jobs and keep employers unable to compete in international markets. 5. Elimination of the depressions of the business cycle that have resulted when interest rates and reserve requirements have been manipulated by the Fed to rein in out-of-control debt bubbles. 6. The availability of loans at interest rates that are not subject to unpredictable manipulation by a private central bank, but remain modest and fixed, something borrowers can rely on in making their business decisions and in calculating their risks. And 7. Elimination of the aggressive currency devaluations and economic warfare necessary to sustain a money supply built on debt. Exchange rates become stable, the U.S. dollar becomes self-sustaining, and the United States and other countries become self-reliant, trading freely with their neighbors without being dependent on foreign creditors or having to dominate and control other countries and markets. And we will continue in the next show exhibiting how this happy ending is well within the realm of possibility, but how it won't happen unless we the people get our boots on and start marching. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.